Okay. Do you have something that you'd like to share?
I know I had a hard time with most of it. But the only thing that I could retain was the area where they were talking about reverential behavior.
Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. I like that. I like reverential behavior. Okay.
Which I'm really working on these days.
Well, if you're working on it, you're in good company. Because that's what we're all working on, too.
Yes.
Nobody said they had it mastered yet, so don't put us in that boat. You ever read Gomorrah?
Well, the translation in 1 Peter was incredible, just, you know, about the wives, but specifically, let the character, let the soul's hidden true beauty's character, which is humble in its faithful, peaceful, tranquil spirit, which is precious before God. For in this manner, righteous Jewish women of the past trusted in God, adorning themselves by and submitting to their husbands. That statement was just profound to me. And then the explanation on the next page, on 41.
Yes, ma'am.
I just enjoyed the whole thing, but I really thought that that was great. And then there was a statement toward the end of the Nazarene Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
Says on page 43, this 15th year calendar is very interesting because it follows a pattern of Gentile conversion. Here our point is that when the Gentiles turns to God, he is immersed into a deep soul atmosphere in the beginning. And then, you know, I think about how the church, when someone gets saved, they tell them to go to John, but they don't tell them where to go next.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So they get that little bit of soul and that excitement, but they have no idea what they're reading.
Right.
So without proper training, they're just lost. And then they end up drifting back because that feel-good soul feeling is gone, that initial excitement and stuff.
Right.
So those are the two things that really fired my imagination.
Very good. Very good. You read Seneca?
I guess I like the idea that talking about in the Psalms,
uh-huh,
where you talk about that when you speak, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it, it's your tone of voice, it's, you know, the look on your face. We read into everything.
Right. Very good. Very good. Zimmons, Rabbi Dr. Hillel, is accused and charged with plagiarism. He found it exciting what we did on page 27, where it says, "So it came about on the third day, when it was the morning, that there were thunder." That's the voices. In Hebrew, it's the word kolot. Plural, Hebrew, not just one voice, but it's in the plural, kolot. But it says the word thunder. So you say, well, wait a minute, you know, I thought there were thunder and lightnings happening on the mountain. And the answer to that question is, yes, if you absolutely must think in Peshat, in the plain literal interpretation of the text, that's what you would see. However, the day that is being spoken of here is a day, rabbis use the expression, the day that the world stood still. And the reason they say that the world stood still is because Hebrew word for heaven is Shemayim. Okay? Always in the plural, never in the singular. So if you look at our writings, typically we will never say that it is heaven. It's always the heavens, okay? It's always in the plural. But the root of this word, you can see, is Shem. Shem means there. Okay? The Hebrew word for earth is Eretz. And its root will be rots, R-A-T-Z, meaning running to or running toward. So with Eretz, you see that there's something running to there. Okay? So the earth, the whole concept of the earth is that it will run, it will go to Shemayim, into the heavens, into the world of God. So what this means is that everything that we do halakhically, which means how we keep the commandments, so everything that we do in our life is an expression of what we learned at Mount Sinai, 613 commandments, etc., etc. So everything that we are, our whole aim, our whole objective is to get back to Sinai, as it were, and find that moment. Because in the moment that God said, for example, I am the Lord your God, as soon as he says that exact phrase, everything in the entire cosmos came to a place of absolute unity. No, there was absolutely no division, no disunity, nothing at that specific moment. And so what happens is, once that we reach that moment, then we're there. And so anybody knows, if you're on a trip going from one place to another, from here to there, when you get there, you don't go somewhere else, right? You're there. So the whole idea of the earth running toward the heavens is that once you get to there, you're there. And on that day, everything arrived at that perfect moment of unity with God, so that it's as if the world stood still because it had achieved at that moment divine perfection. So this is the voices of the Hakamim, and the lightning flashes, or the Hakamim running back and forth in the Torah. Now, His Eminence said that I made a grand leap when I went through this translation, making this translation. And it's not a grand leap in the sense of it being a grand leap, because there's a logical process that took me from point A to point B by looking at the characteristics of the Hakamim, the men of wisdom. And so then you could see that the lightning flashes, or flashes of light, which would run back and forth from here to there, etc. And, of course, then that lightning flash is associated with something deeply, deeply spiritual. And, of course, His Eminence also has a little saying that he uses as far as the way we project what we write. And what he says is that we write in such a way that we reveal a certain amount of material, and then we expose just a little bit of flesh, and then cover it back up so you don't realize what happened to you. And this is very much like a woman who is nicely dressed, and she just lets you see perhaps her ankle or maybe her wrist or whatever your choice might be. And then all of a sudden you're stimulated by this moment that you've seen this piece of exposed flesh, and then all of a sudden it's gone. So this is what we do with writing. We dump something in that if you want to go on a search and find rescue, you'll find the deeper side of things being written inside of the text, which we never tell you they're there. So it's yours to hunt and find. So the flashes refer to the Tree of Life. Tree of Life. Okay? And we'll talk about some of that later. So then they're running back and forth to elucidate the Torah. And the thick cloud is always associated, the cloud is always associated with the word kibod. Or kibod, which is glory. And It is connected with the idea of the Shekinah, which the Shekinah, or the presence, divine presence of God. But it usually, the cloud is more an enveloping or an envelopment of those who are in the glory of God. The Shekinah is the manifest presence of God, the neighboring. It literally means the neighboring presence of God. So that means that God is very, very near or very close. So that, and that came down on the mountain, and now obviously if you're thinking in literal terms, Peshat terms, then you have a mountain, but if you have Remez or Drosh, you have the higher levels of interpretation, then you have the governance of God, the kingdom of God, God's kingdom, and how the governance goes with this. This works really extremely well with Midrash. And through the Bati Din, etc., in a very loud voice, a call, a shofar, which is the Tiferet. Someone talked about the prophet, the Tiferet, the Darshan, is in the middle of the Tree of Lights, and he is called the prophet, the Magid, the prophet. And so the people in the camp of the whole world literally trembled at that moment. The reason the whole world trembled at that moment is because according to the sages, the voice of God literally encircled the entire globe, and it stopped at every last individual on the globe and said, these are the commandments. Will you or will you not keep them? And you said?
Yes.
Yes.
Otherwise you wouldn't be here. But there was a prize for saying yes. And the children of Israel experienced it midrashically. Now, we will pick up on something that Givorah was saying before class. You have Peshat, literal. You have Remez, allegory. You have Drosh, parable. And you have Sod, which means spiritual or secret. Okay, something hidden or something disclosed. Now, here is literal, and everything in these brackets are non-literal. Okay, the reason we say these things is because you need to come to an awareness that when things are said in any one of the three of these categories, what happens is we literally take them out of the literal, and now they're not literal anymore. So, if I say that there is a mountain and all the people were on the mountain and we're in Remez, Drosh, or Sod, we're not speaking literally anymore. Okay? So you have to throw literalism out the window, so to speak, so you can begin to think in a more abstract way to comprehend what's being said. So, we say a mountain, in literal terms, we're talking about a place that you go out and climb to the top. If it's non-literal, then it is
God or something.
Kingdom. One way for us to understand is kingdom, because the mountain always is that which is elevated, that which is high, and it always represents a kingdom, or somebody's kingdom, governances, or etc. So when you see mountains, biblically speaking, it's talking about different rules, different powers, different authorities. Okay, this particular mountain that we're talking about is the mountain of God. Therefore,
kingdom of God.
You should understand that what you're looking at is the kingdom of God and how the kingdom of God functions. The reason we associate with the Hakamim or the Bati Din with the mountain is because this is the way that God governs the entire world. He governs the world through the oral Torah, through the things that He spoke out of His mouth. This speaking started before man was capable of hearing or there to hear, but he starts speaking and he puts this entire plan to action. We'll talk about this perhaps more in a little while. So understanding that whenever we get into something that is beyond the literal, then we start looking for allegory, parable, or sa'od. And when we talk about sa'od, it is something here perhaps a little bit easier to comprehend is symbols. Okay? So, for example, we've done it 100 times, and we'll do it 100 more times if need be. When you look at the book of Revelation, and you open to the book of Revelation, let's go there for 1 second. You need one?
Chuck has one in mind.
You guys need one? Okay. Now I say this in a very special way so that everybody can understand. Verse 1. The revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach. Question. What is the revelation about?
Yeshua HaMashiach.
Okay. Which God gave to him? Who is him?
Yeshua.
Yeshua. So this is the revelation. This is the revealing what God revealed to Yeshua himself concerning himself as the Messiah. Okay, are you with me? Now it says, so that he could show his servants. So his servants in this case can be either God's or Yeshua's Talmudim. Okay? And it fits well with both. That they will be given things that they need to know soon. Okay? And then it said he sent, and now I know how to speak English, but I say this way because it's very important that we understand what's happening this. I say he sent and signified it, giving it to his servant, literally through an angel or through a messenger. Okay? So, you understand here that everything that is in this book is in symbols. If you don't understand the symbols, stay out of the book. Because all you're doing is playing with something that will lead you absolutely in a direction that you have no understanding of. Unfortunately, the great difficulty that we face in our world today is that we have all of these so-called scholars, excuse me, that think they want to make all these proclamations about what the book is about, but they don't have the first clue about the symbols, and they definitely don't have a clue about how to go about applying hermeneutic. Okay? So, for example, one thing that I tell people when they read the book of Revelation is that there's always an interpretive key in sa'od. So when you're reading the symbols, there's always an interpretive key. Okay? If you have a map and you see symbols on the map, what good are the symbols if you don't have a key to understand the symbols? Yeah. Right? Otherwise, you might be looking for a rest stop and you take a rest stop for a gas station and whatever, right? So then you're in trouble. But the key, first of all, is to understand that it's in symbols. Then if you go to verse 20, okay? Now, I didn't read a piece here, but you can read this for yourself at some other point in time. But what he does here is that as for the mystery, here's the word in Hebrew would be the word sa'od, down here at the bottom for our symbols. He said here, he said the mystery of the 7 stars that you saw in the right hand and in the 7 menorot, golden menorot, the menorah, stands the 7 stars and their messengers. The word angel means messenger. It's a lot more than that, but nevertheless, okay? So the angels and the 7 congregations are the 7 congregations and the 7 lamps are the 7 congregations. There are seven men, messengers inside of the congregation, and then it will move to that. So you have a key for interpreting what's going on there. Okay? So before I forget, Dr. Elisheva, your turn. What was... I almost ran off and left her, but...
Oh, that's all right. I didn't mind. Mine was in the Torah Seder itself, and it's in verse 8. And it's the scenario is Aaron, because of the sin of the golden calf, he was afraid to go to near the altar and to sacrifice the first sacrifice. He was afraid because he knew that he had done the sin of the golden calf, and he was terrified. But then in verse 8 says that Aharon, after he was told to go ahead and do it, Aharon approached the altar with resolution. And sometimes, whenever we don't know where we're supposed to go and what we're supposed to do, we just have to square our shoulders and grit our teeth and move with resolution. And that is true faithfulness is and obedience. It's when you move with resolution, even though you're scared, to go ahead and do it anyway. It always is where God wants us to be, at that place where we'll put all of our trust in Him.
Amen.
So I like that very much.
And of course it says there in the Targum, it says that the adversary, now understanding the word Satan, okay, Satan is not this arch enemy of God, etc. Satan just means the adversary. And truthfully, do we say this tactfully? You are your own devil. Right?
Yep.
I mean, nobody scares me worse than me. And I'm not playing games of, you know, how tough or whatever macho I am. I have to live with me, and I know the things that I have to overcome of me. And so that's the villain that I have to face. So here is Aharon, the gentleman who is now being crowned as the high priest, and he's being sent into the Mishkan, the tabernacle, to sacrifice a calf. And this is what he was able to produce for all of them that wanted this intermediary between God and them and made a golden calf, etc. Okay? So, yeah, sure. He walks in there and he's thinking, you know, if I get in here and nobody's to look, you know, we think we talked about the kill radius of lightning, you know, what's going to happen to me if I make a mistake? Don't worry. It'll all come out in the wash. Okay? Very good. That's an excellent. I enjoyed that piece myself. Dung your well.
I enjoyed all the yellow places.
Are you talking about the verbal tallies? Or
No, I'm talking about every place. I mean, there's such insight. And every place there's a yellow mark all throughout.
Why do you think those guys do that?
I don't know who does that, but I'm telling you, they really know how to mark that yellow.
Emphasis.
Emphasis. They wouldn't be waving a flag or anything like that, would they? Now, the real key, though, is understanding if it's underlined, bolded,
and then highlighted,
then you know really on top.
You're going to have to pay attention, pay attention. You're going to have
that memorized.
That's right. Okay, so you had something else.
I really enjoyed the Targum of Yonatan. I enjoyed just the extra little bits, pieces that he throws in there. And, you know, pick out one or two of them, but I enjoyed it all.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I always like the Targum. Targum is translation/commentary, and you'll always find something that will encourage you there. Adon Suriel.
I enjoyed the Nazarene Koso, where a submissive wife we could find,
mm-hmm.
the tiger wives.
Tiger wise.
That we.
Did it say Tiger wise in there anywhere?
But when you know, whenever I read this and studied that, it's like, wow! It just comes out to me. That's the way life ought to be. You know, with the wife, you can understand what your relationship is.
Very good. Very good. Okay.
Yeah, it's
like a wild wind in a little box. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I had it right here. One of the things that turns out to be extremely difficult in circles where you read this Nazarene codicil, and you come across these passages where it then begins to talk about, you know, women submitting and women being quiet and all that. Of course, men walk very carefully when they start to talk about all these things, right, Gibber at Ruth?
I was going to say, that's an ode, because she's not quiet. She's not quiet at all.
It's definitely not literal. And so then when we talk about mountain here, government is very, very far from you, right? Okay, we'll get back to all of this in a few minutes. I started to take off before... before we ever left the station, okay? On in your siddur, I didn't ask you to bring it tonight, but here you have it. On page 143, we start the place that we read on Friday evening, and it's called the Shetkeil. And this is basically interpreted as the woman of valor. And it comes from Proverbs 31, and there it starts out and it says, a submissive wife who can find. Everybody remembers that verbatim?
I remember those words.
You need to pay more attention to detail. Because I actually just misquoted what it says. And all the women are looking at me very sternly because they know I misquoted it. Okay, but it sounded good to the men, so they didn't say anything either, right? Okay. So it says a proficient, as Gibret Givora corrected us, a proficient woman who can find. Far above pearls is her value. Her husband trusts her. Nothing is more precious than that trust. And his wealth will therefore not be lacking. She does good for him and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with her hands willingly. She is like a merchant ship. From afar does she bring her bread, and she arises while it is still night. She gives food to her household and daily rations to her maids. She makes plans for a field and acquires it. And from her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She girds her loins with might. And she strengthens her arms. Now, stop right here for a second. How in the world is... what does this girl look like, you know? G.I. Jane? Or what do we got going on here? Why did she strengthen her arms? Why would it talk about this? What is all that about?
So she can carry her baby.
Actually, there's a place, you were with us, we went to Megiddo, okay? In Megiddo, there's a place where what they used to do in antiquity is when warfare would break out, you needed to be able to withstand what's a siege, right? So you need essential things for withstanding a siege. One of them is going to be your food, and the other is going to be your water, right? In Megiddo, the water storage system was inside of the city, but its water source inside of the city was very deep down into the ground. So the women were in charge of bringing the water for cooking, cleaning, bathing, etc., etc. So if you went down here to where the source of water was, and then you saw what the women would have to do to carry the water back up out of this thing in a pot or whatever they had, you would understand that she was not today's picture of femininity, okay? She was a pretty rough girl, if you will say. Not rough, but she was very, very
stout,
and she was physically fit, okay? But she could do this with no problem, okay? Realizing that her merchandise is good, her light is not extinguished at night, she stretches out her hand to the staff and her palms to hold the spindle. She stretches out her hand to the poor, and she sends forth her hand to the destitute. She fears not for her household will suffer from the snow, i.e., hitting home today, right? It said, for her entire house is dressed in red woolens. So obviously they all have red long johns, and they know how to survive the cold. She prepares fine bedding for herself. Her attire is a fine linen and crimson wool. Her husband is known at the gates, and when he sits with the elders of the land, and she makes cloaks and sells them, and gives girdles to merchants. Her attire is strength and dignity. She will rejoice on her last day. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and teachings of kindness is on her tongue. She oversees the goings-on of her household and does not eat the bread of laziness. Her children rise to laud her, her husband to praise her, saying, many daughters have succeeded you, but you have excelled them all. False is charm, vain is beauty. A God-fearing woman is one deserving of praise. Give to her from the fruit of her hands. Her deeds will praise her at the gates. Interestingly, in this entire piece, you'll notice that it puts her very much in control of the entire house. Okay? And because the husband is married to this woman, he has a measure of dignity, etc., because obviously she is a very dignified woman. So, excuse the expression, a true biblical woman is not a woman who is the one that they refer to as eye candy. Okay? That doesn't mean she has to not be that way, but the whole point is that, as we said in the commentary and as we look at the Nazarene Codicil, the true beauty of a person, male or female, is not in their physical or extraneous physique, as it were. It is the true beauty of the individual who is on the inside. And nobody appreciates this more than men and women of maturity who have been married for some time and realize that, you know, when I look in the mirror, I see that the beard that was dark and the hair that was dark is now gray. There's not as many of them. And some of the places that were six packs turn into 12 packs and all those things, right? And so the one who puts his emphasis on beauty and not the inner beauty will immediately be trouble with their marriage. But when you can find those souls that truly resonate with one another, whether it be that we're on exactly the same key or whether we're on the harmonic, then we know that we have met with what is that God would have us to have. So I think pretty much what I had to say is about the idea that here it uses a model, and the model that it uses as a woman who would fit this Eshet Keil is Sarah. Now, the thing about Sarah that is very amazing is that here she is married to, we call him the centurion, right, the 100-year-old man, and now she's going to have a child. But it says that just prior to this, they had gone into Egypt, and they'd gone into Egypt, and Pharaoh, now this woman is probably up in her 70s by now, but Pharaoh was so struck with her beauty that he thinks, that's the woman I want for a wife. It's pretty amazing that this woman attracts his eye at this age, right, and is so beautiful. And so it literally turns out that this woman, Sarah, is the picture of beauty in all of her goings on, as it were. So she is the vessel that is truly a vessel of honor, and she is truly a woman of valor, in sense of valor. Now, I know people would like to go and pick up women like Deborah, and you know, Deborah was a judge, and she was also a warrior. So, you know, when you have these pictures of women like that, you know that from time to time, that doesn't mean it's not happening in this generation, but certain women rise to meet the call of God in whatever capacity they have to. There was a story about Golda Meir, and how the Prime Minister said he just wished he had a few women like her, or excuse me, a few men like her, because she was very tenacious. She went to America and comes back with, they were hoping she would come back with a few thousand dollars. Unfortunately, she disappointed them by bringing back millions rather than a few thousand dollars. She really did her job, okay? So one of the things that's very interesting about this text is that if you look here at what Hakamsafet Peter is saying, he says, similarly, wives being subject to their own husbands, and now understanding this, the vocabulary in Greek as well as in Hebrew, so when you use the word woman in Greek or Hebrew, that's what it means. It means a woman. So contextually, here we have to derive that this is not some woman who is being asked to be subjective to every man in the congregation. She is to find her true relationship and true place with her husband. Okay, but it's very interesting in this particular piece because we find what Hakamsafet does. And understanding that he's going to lay down the Peshat, right? So if we start with the Peshat and the literal, that he lays down this piece of material that is very important for us to see. Now if you look, I think I did this. Perhaps I did not. If you look at what Hakamsafet has done, you can actually go to the book of Corinthians, you can go to the book of Ephesians, you can go to several places and hear Paul, Hakamshaul, echo these exact same words. Okay? So he's echoing that which he's heard his mentor teach, and he's saying something very similar. So what I want to do is I actually want to go to Ephesians, if you will. Chapter 5. Now, something will not resonate with you as it did with me, but I will try to elaborate. In Ephesians, Hakamshaul's egret, his letter to the Ephesians, is divided into seven sections. okay, which literally divides into 49 sections, okay? Obviously, you would understand seven sections inside of seven, right? Seven sevens is 49. Am I right? Is that right?
You're right.
Okay. So, what happens is that Ephesians is actually set for us to read during the time immediately following Passover, Pesach, and literally the day after, and we start reading and counting the Omer. Okay? We're to count the days between Pesach and Shavuot or Pentecost, which Pentecost means 50, but we never count 50. Never. Never, 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 never. Okay? We don't count 50 because what we do is we experience 50. Okay? You count 49 and then the next day is the day, then you say, okay, we counted 49, now we're in the experience. And again, we talked about going to Har Sinai or Mount Sinai, and it takes us 50 days to get from Egypt to Har Sinai or Mount Sinai. We prepared at the foot of Sinai for 3 days, and then, as we read earlier, the 3 days, Moshe goes to the top of the mountain, and God speaks from the top of the mountain, giving the mitzvot, giving all the commandments. Okay, but you have seven sevens, and during this period of time, there are seven men, or seven particular pakidim. A pakid is a clerk. And he serves the bench. Okay? And the bench is a bench of judgment, and it is three judges. Minimum. Excuse me. Okay, so these pakidim, the reason they're called clerks is because what's happening to them inside of this arena, if you will, of the synagogue, the asnoga, is that they're working with the Beit Din. They're working with these judges. As they're working with these judges, the judges hear all kinds of cases, every kind that you can imagine. Now, keeping in mind, in Judaism, there is no such thing as civil law, and there's no such thing as religious law. It's all Torah. It's all one thing. So civil law and religious law are the same. So if you violate the Sabbath, Shabbat, if you violate Shabbat, Shabbat is just as you're guilty of that, just the same as you would be if you sold somebody's donkey. Okay? It doesn't matter because it's something that God prohibited for us to do is to violate the Shabbat. Just the same as it would be if we go and we take our neighbor's donkey or sheep or whatever. Okay, so minimum of three judges. But these pakidim are serving the bench of three, minimum of three, and they hear all these cases. And so what this literally does is the process of working as a pakid brings them to the level and prepares them to come to the place of eventually being a judge themselves or a rabbi themselves. Okay? A chacham. Now, when we start out with these men, the three men who serve at the bench, who are at the bench, take three particular positions. Number one, they take the position of Chokhmah. Number two, they take the position of Bina. And third, basically, is that of Da'at. Okay? Now, we're speaking here of... We're speaking of things that have a source in Sa'od, but they also have a practical application. And we're talking basically about the practical application right now. Okay? So now obviously your question is like, how on earth does any of this relate to anything that we're talking about with regards to the women, etc.? We said seven men there, but actually there, in all practicality, there's only six men and one woman. Okay? The six men are the different offices of the Pakidim. The one woman, she works for Mossad. Okay, do you know who Mossad is? What Mossad is?
We just went
over this. And, yeah,
means fly.
Yeah.
She's the fly. Mm-hmm. The fly in the ointment, right?
Fly on the wall.
Fly on the wall, because she's the spy. You know, the fly sitting up there is hearing everything that goes on, and nobody's recognizing there's a fly in the room. So this is the idea of Mossad. It's the Israeli
Secret Service,
CIA, etc., whatever equivalent we have. So this is the role of the woman. She goes to one of the parishioners' homes, and, hi, how you doing? And, you know, women have their chat, etc. And she slowly makes her way around, and she looks in the cupboard. Pantry. She's just looking to make sure that, of course, nobody's having pork chops for dinner, right?
Make sure everybody's taking care of it.
She goes to the refrigerator. Make sure there's no pork chops in the refrigerator. No, she's not dubious like this. What she's interested in, do they have enough food? Are they being taken care of? Are they clothed, etc.? She's not there because she wants to say, oh, look at you, you're doing that wrong. It's not a finger-pointing thing. So her reason she is there is because she's one of those pakidim, as it were, who is sincerely concerned with the welfare of the rest of the congregation. So she is there. She relates to one of the sphera that's called Yesod. Okay? Yesod is foundation, etc. It's known by many different titles, but Yesod. Now, the reason I go about bringing you to this place is because understanding that when Hakam Shaul, Paul, wrote Ephesians, he knew that this would relate to the counting of the Omer. Okay? Not only did he understand that it would be to the counting of the Omer, he had this pattern of these seven individuals inside the congregation. Okay? So he understands that there's going to be six men and one woman in the congregation, and the woman would have this basic role of doing the things that she has done only a woman can do. And so, interestingly, it's coincidental, purely coincidental, it couldn't have been by any other design, that the piece that we're now speaking of, where women's are to, quote, submit themselves to their husbands, etc., falls out to be exactly in the middle of the section where we're talking about the woman and talking about Yesod. Now, that may not mean a whole lot to you at this point, but let me tell you, it's very, very profound. I mean, what this says is basically that Hakam Shaul Paul was not the village idiot. Far from. Because, listen, how do you take 49 sections? Now, these are combinations that are altering back and forth. And how do you take 49 sections and then weave out and make it fit to this particular thing? Oh, I know, I'll put this in right here. Oh, I'll put that in right here. Oh, he is very methodic in what he does, and he brings it out very clearly here. So we're in Ephesians chapter 5. We're going to look at verses 24 through 28. And this is the translation His Eminence and I have worked on, and so hopefully you will see something. Said, now just as the Asnoga, just as the synagogue, starting verse 24, must submit to Messiah, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Messiah also loved the Asnoga, the congregation, and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify it apart and cleanse it with the washing of the water, excuse me, of the Torah. And this, that he caused it to stand by himself as a glorious congregation without spot or anything, but that it should be holy, without blame. Therefore men should follow the example of Messiah and love their wives as their own bodies, and he who loves his wife loves himself. Okay, this is not vain ego that's being spoken of here. Okay, because he understands that just as the command was to love your neighbor as yourself, you do the same thing for your spouse, right? In other words, rather than say, "You know, man, I really would like to have that Lamborghini," and then the only thing you're thinking about is, you know, what you want, we have to think about, you know, you love yourself, you love your spouse as you love yourself. Now, he says here something that the innuendos that are being spoken here come from somebody who is steeply educated in Torah and knows Torah forwards and backwards. So let's just slowly go through for a second. He said, just as the congregation, the synagogue, submits to Messiah. So each one of us are submitting to Messiah. Now, the only way that a man of authority can understand authority is if he is under authority and he submits to authority. Am I right? Okay, when he understands his place in authority, then he can be authority. And when he has the information, the tools, etc., that he needs to function in that office, then he can be an authority in that office. If he doesn't have all the tools and the rules, etc., then he cannot function there. Okay? So, what he's saying here is that, you know, for us to function in the office, we have authority in that office because we understand all the parameters of what we're supposed to do. He said, so let the wives submit to their own husbands in everything. This is not a idea that we have in so many of the circles today where it's like, let's put the woman down and let's elevate men and then whatever. And by the same token, it's not on the other side where we have to have all the women's rights and all these things. Not that we don't need them. That's not what I'm saying. But the point here is that if it's all balanced the way that it's supposed to be, which is it's truer in Judaism than it is in any other faith. If you will understand that Jewish men reverence their wife. Now there's places and times when I know that women are being suppressed in Judaism, and that is absolutely opposite the norm. That's not the norm, okay? By and large, Jewish men really show reverence to their wives. Listen to me. Excuse me, because sometimes language, it has to be used that expresses. If the man is to abstain from his wife for the period of her cycle, and he does so, that's absolute reverence for the woman. See what I'm saying? He says to himself, the woman can say no, that's not what's going to happen. But he says in his own mind, no, it's not going to happen because this is the proper way for the Torah to function, right? So understanding that when you understand those rules, then inside of those rules is absolute liberty. Okay? For example, I heard a story about a young man. His mind was deficient in some areas. And so he was attending a very special class. Where he was at in school, he was attending this particular class. And one day, the teacher had to step out and speak with someone. And so a substitute came into the room to take care of these children, and all the children in the room were basically the same thing. And so it was hot, and the window was open, and they were on the second, third story. And so all of a sudden, alarmingly, the teacher looks up, and she sees this young boy in the window about ready to fall out or leap out the window. And she's in an absolute panic. She doesn't know what she's supposed to do. About that time, just as it would be, the teacher that normally taught the class came in and saw the individual inside of the window about to go out, and she said, "Get down from there. You don't have a permission from the office to be in that window." The young man crawls down out of the window, and that's the end of the story. But you see, what we need and what we fail to often appreciate is the fact that we do need boundaries. And we find these boundaries, and these boundaries are wholesome boundaries, and when they're established inside of that place, it's just like absolute freedom. You don't worry about, you know, am I going to do this wrong or do that, whatever. You understand that this is the way we're supposed to be, okay? This is what's happening. Now, this is what's going on in Paul's mind when he's in this passage. He understands all the halakha. He's not here to fabricate something. He's been in Judaism. He said, you know, I'm a Jew, the son of a Jew, etc., etc. I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, on and on and on. Now, scholars don't like to hear that, right? Because they want to put all the Pharisees down, and, you know, that's a negative thing. But guess what? I think Jesus was a Pharisee. All of his disciples were Pharisees. Paul was a Pharisee. Something got to be wrong with this picture of the Pharisees, because guess what? All the Pharisees can't be bad. Sure, I'm sure there's some bad tomatoes, but guess what? We'll make tomato sandwiches later. Okay, so now he says here, let the wives, you know, do to their husband and everything. My wife is sitting here, she can testify to anything I say. Okay? She loves it. Why? It's your responsibility. She doesn't have to make that decision. That's your responsibility, she says. She's going to voice her opinion? Perfectly so. No problem here. Not at all.
But ultimately, if you make the decision, that's between him and God, and I'm out of it.
Who's responsible? Who's he going to hang high? Okay, you got the picture, all right? She'll be like the guy on Hogan's Heroes, right?
I don't know anything.
I know nothing.
Okay, so Paul knows all of this. What is he's talking about the women that they do this to their husbands, love your wives, he goes on to. Even as Messiah so loved the Asnoga and gave himself for it, that you might sanctify. Here he uses the vocabulary that we just discussed about the woman and the mikvah, etc., right? By washing of the water of the word, the Torah. But let's be very, very specific, okay? So now we're going to do something that you all love. We're going to do a little Greek. Okay? Logos. You probably are familiar with this word logos. You probably heard the word logos before. Logos basically is like a word, saying, number of things, right? Okay. So, if he says the washing of the water of word, there is a potential in Greek that it could be this word logos. If it's logos, or logos as some will say, it will have a synonym in Aramaic called the Mimra. Okay? And in Hebrew, Dabar. Okay? So, it could be that here, and these, interestingly enough, all these are synonyms for Messiah. But there's this other word that is used in Greek called rhema. Rhema, Paul uses by no accident. Okay? Why, how can we make this statement? How come we say it like this? First of all, you understand that the Torah lays down certain mitzvot, commandments. But the difficulty is how do we keep the commandments is the big question, right? So if I tell you or read to you from the Torah and it says that we have to keep Shabbat, then for the ones who have the idea of sola scriptura, which means the Bible only, nothing outside of the book right there that we hold, and that would mean actually in these particular Bibles there's a considerable amount of stuff that need to be taken out, because and all the headings would have to be scribbled out, right? Because that implies that you should be reading this into that piece of text. And we say?
Baloney,
that's right. Okay, so sola scriptura does not work. You need explanation as to how these things work for you to understand how they work. Okay? One of those mischievous thoughts just went right through my head.
I saw it, too.
I won't do
that. Can't do it on camera tonight. I'll save that for later.
I already had my fun with it, so it's okay. All right. This word rema is very, very specific. It does not just mean a word, a saying, etc., etc. It speaks only of that which is spoken. Only. Nothing else. It never refers to that which is written. It never refers to anything but something that has been orally communicated to someone else. So, it's not very hard here to put 1 + 2 together and understand that Rama speaks directly of the oral Torah. Okay, this is absolutely elementary at this point. It is absolute elementary grammatics. So, what you will see here then is this. The explanation for how husbands and wives, etc., how that they interact with one another, this material comes from the oral Torah. It does not, the spoken Torah, it does not come strictly from the written, which this can be written or otherwise. Now, Rama does bear some synonym with these ideas here, in that the oral or the spoken part is Messiah. Okay? There's no question about the association with Messiah. But the beauty here is what Chacham Shaul does is because he does not speak. If you don't understand the rules, you totally miss it. Now watch. He says, women, so let your wives submit, basically, he says, to your husbands and everything. Husbands, love your wife, even as Messiah loved the snow and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify, set apart, or to cleanse it with the washing of the water. So here, he's not speaking at this point of women who go to the mikveh. What's he talking about? The oral Torah is what does the cleansing of the individual. Okay? But here the interesting thing is, who is the subject?
The husband.
Absolutely. And so you see what's happened here? There's an absolute role reversal in what's being mentioned here, because the only way that the husband and the wife can be reunited is after she goes to the mikvah. Okay? When she goes to the mikvah, she comes back, she is literally, in rabbinic terms, born again. Man gets a new wife every month. See, so Judaism's got all the bases covered, right? That's why we have far less divorce than you. No.
There's no midlife crisis.
I'll see you next month.
No, new you. Different you.
I hope the other woman is willing to do hot housework.
So here, he's speaking of the man, and he's speaking of some things that are extremely, extremely deep with regards to how that men and women conduct themselves. So I want to try to pick back up something and see if we can tie all this together. The sanctity of relationships is absolutely dependent upon an appreciation for the Torah. Okay? One thing I can know about my beloved is that I'm not first in her life. And it's okay with me. Because she's been having a love affair right under my nose. And someone has described her as a wild wind in a small box. But the reason I say this, and of course she would have said the same thing, if not she's here to speak for herself, is that she loves God and the Torah more than she loves me. And for this I'm extremely grateful. But she knows that it's the same way with me. She is extremely high on the ladder inside of my heart, but Hashem and the Torah is number one. When this is put into the relationship in this way, Hashem, God, and the Torah, the relationship, it's nearly impossible for that relationship to fall. Because you don't fear the individual, the husband or whatever, that, and that's not even an issue in this case. The fear is God. And, you know, we're not here to beat heads or anything like that, so please. The point I'm trying to make is the beauty of the Torah, the beauty of the relationship that one has with the Torah. Now, find me, you have your Bible with you? No?
I have.
Song of Solomon, do Song of Solomon, and you can just start in the first chapter there and read a couple of verses with me. But is that what?
So what are we?
Is it New King James, or it's got its own?
New American Standard.
Would you say non-American Standard, would you say?
New.
Is that like the non-inspired version? Okay. Now, in case you're wondering, this language is going to be somewhat metaphoric. Okay? You there?
Start reading where?
Chapter 1. Start off.
Okay.
That's an English Polish Bible. I don't know. Well, it won't go the other way.
Are you
going to start reading? One?
If I figure out where chapter 1:1 is, then we read.
See there? That's one of those Bibles.
Oh, I found it now.
You did, okay.
The pages are sticking together. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon.
Okay, stop. Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Okay? This isn't just some little medley he wrote down. This is the song. Okay? I mean, number one. It's like it hit the top charts in, what, a few thousand years B.C. But anyway.
It's been running number one ever since.
It's been running number one ever since. So this is the song of all the songs that he wrote. And there's places that tell us he wrote over 1,000 songs. Prolific songwriter. Poetry, etc. Go ahead, please.
May he kiss me with the kisses of his
mouth.
Oh,
man. Now, I'm going to do it a little bit more holy, right? Because that's not the holy tongue that he's reading right there. You know, King James is holy tongue. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. I think everybody can see that picture pretty good, right? Okay. Now, this is the picture that Solomon is drawing between the relationship of Israel with God, with Israel with the Torah. So all of a sudden now, kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. What does this mean? Because we're telling you now that this book is poetic. It's not talking about literal kisses, although it sounds pretty good to me. Right? The kisses of the mouth will be the words, the oral Torah that flows out of the mouth and then caresses the individuals that hear them. Only the people who appreciate the oral Torah will enjoy the words as they come out of their mouth, and they are bathed in those words as if they were being covered all over with kisses. Isn't there a song, something like that?
No doubt.
Kiss you all over or something like that? Now I'm giving away my arrow, right?
Until the night closes in here, man.
Oh, yes. It's on the page. Okay, go ahead.
Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth.
You already read that.
And let that sink down into my heart. For your love is better than wine.
Okay, love is better than wine. Okay, go ahead.
Your oils have a pleasing fragrance.
Okay, in other words, guess what? This guy didn't come in out of the field.
He smelled good.
And, you know, after a day's worth of labor and then try to chase his girlfriend around, guess what? He took a bath first.
He's involved in some
and
bath.
He's got some, what is
he's
that stuff? Old Spice? Mind. Back then, it's got to be Old Spice because this is, you know, a long time ago, right?
Or then it would be New Spice.
It was New Spice then, it's Old Spice now. Okay? So, in other words, now the fragrances, she's talking about this fragrances that she's smelling of this individual, and this fragrance that she's smelling is in fact like the Shoshana, the roses. Okay? And that's the fragrance because she will call him later Shoshana, the Rose of Sharon, who has this wonderful fragrance, etc. Which is in our world today, it's an Althea we have here. Go on.
Your name is like purified oil, therefore the maidens love you.
In other words, you know, he was like, it didn't do anything for me, but, you know, a little while back, all the girls were in love with, what was his name? Flavio or...
Fabio.
So that tells you how impressed I was, right? Yeah, very good. So I'm being kind of prophetic, right? Okay, go on.
Draw me after you and let us run together.
Okay, stop right there. My favorite passage in all of the Bible. Draw me, now I'm using holy tongues. We will run after thee. This is the idea of your beloved being the mysterious woman that she is. Because of the mystery, excuse me girls, young ladies, excuse me, women. the women who knows how to play the harp of a man's heart, she's very, very coy. But she's a picture of the Torah. So let's see what she, I'm finished, thank you. Let's see what she's like. Let us awaken to the mystery of the Torah, musing on her day and night. Look, the Torah is the root of the supernal wisdom, hidden and concealed, received only through its wondrous pathways. How wondrous are its offshoots. That is why Israel's sweet singer, King David, sang, "Open my eyes, that I may focus on the mysteries of your Torah." You wonder where we got Torah focus from? Mm-hmm. So, it is a word of Torah. This is what she's like. This is the Torah. This is our lover. This is what she's like. She reveals herself to no one but her lover. The Torah knows the one who is wise of heart, and he hovers about her gate every day.
What verse are you reading?
I'm not reading in any verse. I'm reading poetic, so...
Right. I know it's not from King
that's
James,
right.
The whole
where
thing.
Am I reading from?
Yeah. Your attention?
Secret book.
Okay. Okay.
2, number 90. Zohar. The secret book about secret love affairs. Mm-hmm. See, you think that the mystery novels got it all going. The mystery novel was here long before the mystery novel ever arrived. Said this guy hangs out at the gate every day. Why is he hanging out at the gate? He hopes. He just hopes that she will pass the window and he'll get to see her. But now do you think she doesn't know that he's there?
Oh, yeah, she's coy, though.
So it says, what does she do? Because he's loitering at the gates, right? She reveals her face to him from the palace and beckons to him with a hint. Then swiftly redraws herself to her hiding place. The guy that wrote this knew women to the T, right? She shows her face, and then just about the time you're going to think you're going to get a real good look, she's gone. And what happens to the guy's heart when that happens? Draw me, we will run after thee. Okay? So she reveals her face to him from the palace and beckons to him with the hint, then swiftly withdraws to her hiding place. No one there knows or reflects. Her lover alone does. And the heart and the soul of everything within flows out to her. This is why Torah reveals and conceals herself. So you see that we're speaking about the Torah and the beauty of the Torah and the beauty of Bible study, right? Because you can open the book and you look and you read passages and passages and passages and what?
And get nothing. Or.
And then all of a sudden, some little bitty thing shows up and you're just overwhelmed at what you've read because it arouses deep inside of your heart. Said that no one knows her soul, but everything within flows out of her. This is why the Torah reveals and conceals herself with the love she approaches her lover to arouse love within. Come and see the way of the Torah. Very interesting, this phrase. You will always find the phrase, come and see, when it's regard to the deepest mysteries. Okay? If you hear the word come and hear, you're at the level of allegory. But when it says come and see, in other words, now it's not a world of hearing, it's a world of seeing. And the world of seeing is the world of symbols. Okay? We're out of time. Do I need to stop?
No. Who cares about time?
Come and see the way of the Torah. At first, when she begins to reveal herself to someone, she beckons with a hint. What? What did we call that?
Hint, allegory.
Peshat, remez, grosh, sod. Hint. If she proceeds, good. If not, she sends him a message calling him simple. I love it, right? Because, excuse me, men, usually that's us, right?
Pretty simple. I'm a simple guy.
And sometimes she has to bang us on the head and then we get the point. I'm speaking of Torah now.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, the simple, so she calls him simple because he didn't get the hint. You realize that she's calling him this guy that lives in this world all the time, right? And she is saying, the spirit and the bride says,
come.
You're talking about coming up higher, okay? So you can see now the book of Revelation, right? Okay, if he proceeds, good. If not, she sends him a message calling him simple. Torah says to her messenger, tell that simple one to come closer. So I can talk with him, and he approaches. She begins to speak from behind the curtain. She has drawn her words he can follow until he reflects for a little time. Then she converses with him through a veil of words, riddles, and allegory. You see, we could just use the plain literal speech, but the excellency of the Torah is to use speech that is on the next level up. Rather than the plain simple language, it uses language of allegory and riddle. So it's speaking of now, making a transition between these two levels right here. Once he has grown accustomed to her, she reveals herself face to face. Now here we are, finally at this place of Sa'od. And she tells him all of her secrets. And she has revealed to him, withholding nothing, concealing nothing. She says to him, "Do you see that word, that hint, which I first beckoned you? So many secrets there. This one and that one, and human beings should become aware of pursuing Torah to become her lovers." The beauty of these worlds is that literal. And we'll close with this. This is parable. And this is Sa'od, secret, mystery, etc. For the longest time, I tried to discern and understand how the energy of and revelation, if we must use such language, comes to us in this world. And I drew and used two specific models. One model, following this pattern, would go something like this. So we would start here with Sa'od, and here would be Peshat. And of course, we have the other levels here, but each one of these is a principle called Sha'ar, which means gate. Okay, gate. Each time a gate, or like an aperture. Because you understand that the depth of the Torah is, and I use this analogy and illustration almost always because I think it suits well the idea, is that of a camera. When the camera opens, the lens opens, the iris opens up. It opens, but it is so fast that the human eye cannot see how fast. You can tell that it moved, and it opened and it closed, and that's all you know. Okay, but when we first start to receive information, as this piece of the Holy Zohar taught, what happens is the information comes, and the way it talked there, it started out as a hint, something simple, a point to allure. But the truth is, before it could get to this point, it had to go through each of these gates being refined and restricted so that the individual at the bottom of the ladder, as it were, the Torah ladder, the hermeneutic ladder, he could understand, because he cannot start functioning, he cannot open up the Torah and then say, yeah, I understand all of its mysteries. As Gibred Gevorah said earlier, what happens to, generally to, people as they turn to God is they have this deep spiritual experience where they literally are born again. And they see things and their head is in the clouds here, and they actually can, for the first short period of time, that they can actually take in the deep Sa'od of what's going on. And this is the woman, the Torah in the analogy, where she's at the window. And then you see her, and then she's gone because she's playing this elusive game with her lover. And so then you see that the Torah is telling us, come, draw, you know, I'm drawing you, come, run after me. And so then the individual sees that he needs to run after the, is this overwhelming passion that he has for his lover. Now the difficulty in our world today is that you go to the bookstore and people are selling these romance novels by the dozens. Okay? The difficulty with the romance novel is that they don't explain to you that, you know, that is the initial phase that you go through when you enter a relationship. I don't care if it's, you know, your boyfriend, girlfriend, or even personal relationships. For some reason, those relationships, when they first happen, they're very strong. You really like this person, they're really your friend, etc., etc. But the difficulty is, after that moment of spark that has initiated things goes along, what happens? Then it turns into the fact that, guess what? Then things are work. A relationship that is enduring is a relationship that two people have worked on. And so that's where here it starts. Here is this flash of imagination. And then all of a sudden here we're in the very literal world. Stark literal world. Just like that. You wake up and you say, well, where's that spark? Where did it happen? It's as if God gave you the bait, and you took the bait, and then you experienced the rush of the relationship, and then all of a sudden, you realize that, hey, you know, if this thing's going to last, somebody's got to work at doing something, okay? And so the romance novel tells about the flash, but it doesn't tell that after the flash, people are people, and that we have to work on one another, and that we're fame. So it starts out as this place at Sa'od. But here at this place of Sa'od, what happens is there's a level of the divine information, the divine light, the connection to the divine, that at that point you struggle to finally see something. All you see is a light. When we're talking here of the Torah, all you see is a light. You know that there's something there, and you can sense it, and you feel it drawing you toward itself, but that's all you know. You don't know anything else. And so what has to happen is that light needs to come down to your level to where that you can understand what it's trying to beckon you to. But it may start here, and you may see this flash of light here at the beginning, but then it has to be filtered through these different gates. You see, the door is a door to the outside or a door to the inside, right? So you understand that if we open the door and go out, then the whole world is out there. So what you have there is a pathway in or out, but you have also something that restricts or slows things down as it goes through, that like an orifice, okay? You can get one or two people through the door, but everybody can't fit through the door at one time. And it's the same way with the information that it comes down from. So everybody could crowd into this space, but what's going to happen is before it comes down to where people begin to understand it, then it has to be narrowed to the place that they can comprehend. Now, she called him simple. You're just on this level, you poor simple mind. And basically she's saying, come up higher. Come up here. Elevate. Stretch yourself. So she's asking him to go beyond the level of the literal and start to think in more abstract terms. Then think in the parabolic and then think in these abstract terms here, because what she's saying is, look, I am showing you now all of the secrets of the Torah. I'm not withholding anything from you. But what you find here is definitely not the novice. When the secret starts to come, you're not speaking with a novice anymore. You're speaking with somebody who understands how to unfold the layers of the Torah in such a way that they can look at it and they see Torah playing that little game of hiding in and out of the words that they're reading inside of the text. Why do we highlight words in yellow?
He can help us see the secrets.
See the window that is open for you to look and say, hey, I'm right here. There's something for you to see. Look at me. It's not by accident that these things are saying. His eminence goes to great detail in looking at these nuggets that are here and then trying to give you a hint that, yeah, you're reading a word, but guess what? Maybe it takes a little bit more to understand what's going on than just hearing a word. Maybe you need to dissect the word, etc., etc. Okay, so the spiritual mind has to be exercised to get to this point. We start here, but immediately we turn to this point here, and then we have to develop at each level. We have to develop ourselves and condition ourselves to understand the levels of the Torah. So for example, if you're going to understand the Torah, let's say what we said earlier, the book of Revelation, you understand that the medium to understanding the revelation is understanding the symbols that are in the revelation, right? So for example, it said he's in the midst of the seven menorot, the seven menorah, and you see him there, then if you don't know anything about the menorah, you'll never understand the mystery. But if you'll dissect the menorah, then you'll begin to understand the mystery. But it's interesting because the menorah is also a picture of what we begin to talk with at the very beginning, the seven pakidim. Yeah, it's also a picture of that. So if you're looking at the pakidim and you want to understand the pakidim, you understand that the pakidim, the clerks, what these men are that they're a mirror of the menorah. And so if you want to understand them, you have to look at the menorah. If you want to understand the menorah, you have to look at them. Vice versa, right? But in looking at these symbols, then all of a sudden after you understand the function, how it works, and then you deeply think about it. I'm not saying that this is something that you're going to learn overnight, but if you deeply look into these things, then you'll begin to see. Unfortunately, many of the people who are supposed to be interpreters of more mystical things, prophetic things, they don't even have the basics yet. And then they're trying to tell us, you should be afraid. Tomorrow the world's going to end. Look, said Chicken Little, the sky is falling. You know how many times I've heard that?
That's the according to one pastor or reverend or evangelist or whatever you want to call it, our world was supposed to literally end twice in the last decade, according to his mathematical calculations.
And so, he's back taking some math, basic math or what?
I guess.
It's falling really slowly.
It ended, we just didn't notice.
Okay. The answer to that question will be in the next Torah Seder.
So it's hidden there for you to find.
So I just gave you a hint.
For you to go search. Come after me. Come find me.
Come find me.